Let me just introduce you to Dr. Bruce Taylor, who was educated at Manchester and then Oxford, where he earned his PhD. He's the author of Armatures of Reform, The Mercedarian Order in the Spanish Golden Age, and is co-editor of Learning and Society in Spain, From Humanism to the Enlightenment, The Expansion of University Culture. He was a Vicente Cañada Blanch Research Fellow at the University of Manchester and a research affiliate at UCLA's Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies, where he lives and works as a translator in LA. And among other projects, he's working on the biography of Sir Peter Russell, who was Alfonso XIII's professor at Oxford. And Russell was an OSMA student in 1934 to 1935, and Bruce was an OSMA student in 1993 till 94. And he's traveled the way over from LA to be with us today. So thank you very much, Bruce. Floor's yours.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. It's such a... Yo también me escucho. Inviting me to share my personal experiences as one of those fortunate enough to have held the DELSMA studentship these last 100 years. This is a sentimental journey for me, not only, well, for two reasons. First, to recall this lovely time in my life when I held the studentship, but also to come back to Oxford, which I'm rarely able to do now, and see old friends and just swim in these waters again. So thank you very much. This is very important to me at a personal level. I first heard of the Instituto in the context of my doctoral research under Sir John Eliot, then Regius Professor of Modern History, and now Professor Emeritus. And this gives me an opportunity to thank him publicly for his kindness, inspiration to me those years ago. Something never to be forgotten. My subject, as Maria mentioned, was the Mercedarian Order, La Orden de la Merced, an extremely naughty, unruly, rebellious, recalcitrant, and generally ill-assorted order of friars that the Crown and the papacy were attempting to reform with mixed success in the second half of the 16th century. In 1992, that momentous quincentennial year, I traveled to Spain to begin my archival research. And after many months of rewarding work in Barcelona, Valencia, Pamplona, and elsewhere, I made my way to Madrid to complete my research. Although I had not visited any of the Madrid archives, most were well known to me, and they were known quantities. There was the Biblioteca Nacional, the National Library, the Archivo Histórico Nacional, where I remember bumping into my friend Andrew Hegarty, who's here today. And also the Foreign Ministry Archive, the wonderful gem in the Palacio de Santa Cruz, a wonderful place where I was the only researcher ever, with six members of staff to attend to my every need. And then there were two other archives. I knew held part of the famous Altamira collection of papers from the reign of Philip II that were dispersed in the late 19th century. The bulk of that collection is just here in the British Library. And there's another significant tranche that's preserved in the Public and University Library in Geneva. However, the balance of the Altamira collection is held at the Archivo Sabalburu in Madrid, and of course at the Instituto, and that's how I came to visit the establishment that we are celebrating today. That first visit came in the summer of 1993. I was just a week or so away from returning to Oxford and thought I'd visit this last archive before regaling Professor Eliot with my discoveries. Shortly before that visit, I had received intimation from Andrew Hegarty that it might contain material of interest on the Mercedarians. One fine day, I appeared at Calle Fortuny, looking no doubt like a tramp under full sail. I was an impoverished student. And what did I find? A palace, a Mudéjar palace, hard by a Spanish Renaissance palace, standing majestically on a sloping site. Knocking on the door, I was invited inside, where I was led upstairs, where to my surprise I found myself in the epitome of a English library in the Victorian style. Complete with a bridge spanning the gallery. It looked just like Professor Higgins' library in My Fair Lady. I expected Eliza Doolittle to poke her head round the door at any moment. So I was shown to a carved desk, and I was brought the catalogue. I hadn't been looking at it very long when I realised that Andrew was right. Because listed there was envio, which I suppose you translate into English as shipment or package or dispatch, number 72, part 2. Not part 1, part 2. Mithridatios, it said. Mercedarians, 500 folios. So I ordered up the documents, which were very soon on my desk, and what I had before me were the papal nuncio's papers for the reform of the Mercedarian order in the second half of the 16th century, the very heart of my research. I'd struck gold. I'd like to say that I spent the remaining couple of hours going through these papers, but I didn't. The truth is, I was so overwhelmed by the discovery that I returned in Envio 72 Part 2 pretty smartly and was back on Calle Fortuny within about half an hour. I remember walking along the Paseo de la Castellana wondering how on earth I was ever going to find the time or the funds to study this wonderful trove. Returning to Oxford, I realised that my only hope was the De Osma studentship, to which I duly applied, and with Envio number 72, part 2, featuring very prominently in my application. A few weeks later, Ian Michael, then a professor of Spanish studies here, informed me with the lack of discretion for which he was famous that he had, thank you, recommended me to the Vice Chancellor for award of the studentship. Oh, happy day. The following spring, 1994, I was back in Madrid to take up my studentship. And this was also my first meeting with the librarian of the institution, Don Gregorio de Andrés, whom many of you will remember. Don Gregorio was a distinguished Hellenist and a paleographer, a former professor at Salamanca and at the Autónoma in Madrid, who was well known as the cataloguer of the manuscripts of the Escorial and other major holdings. In 1974, I think it was, he was invited to become the librarian of the Instituto and to catalogue its rich collections. I always remember that first encounter with Don Gregorio. He asked me what I was working on and didn't seem overly impressed when I told him about the Mercedarians, as such was their reputation. I then asked him where he was from. He immediately stiffened and with immense pride shot back, Castilla la Vieja, Old Castile. I then asked him where in particular, to which he answered with equal vigor, Palencia. He then somewhat dolefully told me, which I knew, that the Mercedarians had never had a house in Palencia. Fortunately, I was able to recall that the order's greatest theologian, a man called Francisco Sumel, who was general of the order eventually, was a native of Palencia, and Sumel had participated in the famous disputations in Salamanca in the late 16th century. And Don Gregorio, of course, knew all about Sumel, and so the Mercedarians weren't as suspect after our conversation as they had been before. Thereafter, whenever I was in the Instituto, which was whenever it was open during those memorable months in 1994, he would shuffle over. I'm afraid he wasn't in the best of health, and ask me, ¿Cómo van los Mercedarios? How the Mercedarians doing? And in later conversations, he told me that he had been, I suppose we call it, a near victim maybe of the notorious massacre of the entire 50-strong Augustinian community of the Escorial, which is, of course, a palace monastery, in 1936. And he was a member of that order, which he left in about 1970. And I always remember there were tears in his eyes. It was all too real for him, 60 years on. So he and I had a connection with religious orders, albeit in very different ways, and a wonderful man. I enjoyed my time spent with him very much, and he sadly passed away in 2005. The Instituto, in short, always seemed to me to capture, and it's still the case all these years on, when I have less to do with Spain, what I most loved about Spain, culturally rich inside and out, and with a rich vein of humanity to match, which extended to all the staff who always showed me unfailing kindness. I'd like to close these few remarks by remembering one or two previous holders of the studentship whom I knew, but who are no longer with us. David Patterson worked on Spanish ballads and chronicles, and he was one of those who had the good fortune of having the studentship twice in the 1960s. And particularly, as Marina mentioned, Peter Russell, professor of Spanish studies here from 1953 to 1981, who was awarded the studentship in 1934 and will have recommended so many distinguished holders in later years, including, no doubt, several who are with us today. Much loved, greatly missed, and in fact, I miss him so much, I'm writing his biography. Someone else who can't be with us today for reasons of health, I've already mentioned Ian Michael, that irrepressible ambassador of Anglo-Spanish cultural relations, who I'll hopefully be seeing in Madrid next week. All of these people, all who went before me, all who have come after me, and doubtless the legion yet to come, share a special bond of privilege, product of the munificence of Don Guillermo. So to him and to you all, thank you very much. I'm honored.
And now I get to tell you about the untold history of the OSMA studentship, so digging in the Bodleian archives and other archives as well. But I thought I'd show you this picture. You know, we were there just now, so you will all recognise it. Yes, it is Convocation House, the main legislative body of the university. And as you walk into the Instituto Valencia de Don Juan in Madrid, into the library, and you look immediately to your right, you see an unassuming framed document hung on the wall, on the far wall. And first impressions are often wrong. And sure enough, the document is the official proof of approval of the establishment of the OSMA studentship by the University of Oxford's main legislative body, so Convocation House. So it was also quite symbolic that we had lunch there earlier today. And I'm going to focus on Don Guillermo and Guillermo de Osma and Oxford in three different yet interrelated ways. So first his time as a student here at Oxford, and then the establishment of the research centre of the Instituto in Madrid and its links to Oxford. And finally, the Osmer studentship itself. And this is all based on archival research, as I said, digging in the Bodleian archives here, but also in Madrid. And at the Duke of Alba's palace, the Liria Palace in Madrid, at the National Historic Archive, and of course at the Instituto Valencia Don Juan, which Osmer founded in 1916. In fact, I'm on the studentship, was fortunate enough to win the studentship on the centenary of the foundation of the Instituto. But it was thanks to Cristina, who is here with us today, who's come over from Madrid, that I started somehow thinking about Osmer the man, because she took several people on a tour of the house turned research centre, and showed us Osmer's study. And it so happens that he kept the furniture, including the desk, from his student days at Oxford. He took them back with him. He took them to Paris, back to London, back to Madrid, and that's where they are now. That sort of the picture at the the sort of middle picture there, the bad one. That one hangs on the wall of this of his study, and it's a picture of his rooms at Oxford. So from 1870, and I'm not sure if you can see, but that chair is the same chair he has in his study today. And his Pembroke banner is still there. His sort of sports trophies are still displayed in the study. So that, to me, coming from Oxford, saying, what's all this doing here? Why is there a photograph of an ivy-covered Oxford quad in this study in the middle of Madrid? So that's sort of what pushed me to start thinking not only about the research I was actually meant to do, but, you know, pushing the boundaries of research. And as Duncan said earlier, sort of finding something that, you know, you're not really meant to look into, but it's just so fascinating that you find ways of doing both. So Osmer, this is a photograph of Osmer with his buddies, the junior common room at Pembroke in 1873. But he came to Oxford in 1871. And why 1871 is so crucial is because of the University's Test Act of that same year, which opened the universities of Oxford, Cambridge, and Durham, so the historic universities of England, to non-Anglicans. And this allowed Osmer to come here. It must be said, though, that although non-Anglicans were allowed to study here from 1871 onwards, many English Catholic bishops barred Catholic youths from Oxford and Cambridge for some time, fearing the university's scepticism and Anglican influence, which meant, therefore, that Osmer would probably have been, you know, one of the very, very few Catholics in that cohort at the time, despite, you know, them now being allowed to study here. The official history of the University of Oxford has focused on just how important this test, the University's Test Act, was to open the university to Britons of all faiths. But there's that additional layer of actually opening up the university sort of internationally and allowing, you know, German Lutherans and French Jews and Spanish Catholics to study here, who, you know, weren't allowed to study here before. So the point really is that he must have been an extremely rare sight at Oxford in 1871, due to his faith, his place of birth — he was born in Cuba — and nationality. So in this context, it's not surprising, I think, that his time at Oxford had a crucial effect on him. And Osmond made some lifelong friends at Oxford, including some Maurice de Bunsen. You've seen some of his papers upstairs and in the conservation studio. And Evelyn Hubbard, who were both at Christ Church. And that's quite important because Christ Church is situated right opposite Pembroke. And they both did history, as did Osmond. So they would have all studied history together. And they played a fundamental role in setting up the Osmond studentship later on. Bunsen was British ambassador to Spain between 1906 and 1913, and Hubbard served as director of the Bank of England from 1890 to 1909, and as MP, as Member of Parliament for the City of London between 1896 and 1900. And as I said, they were key in negotiating directly with the Vice Chancellor the Osmond studentship. In fact, according to the registrar of the university, the negotiations were carried with two of them, and later on, the institution had sort of forgotten some of those negotiations. So in a way, it's sort of high university politics at its best, but institutional memory at its worst. Until recently, it was unclear what Osmond had studied. We now know it was history and that he got a first. What's also really interesting is to know more about the syllabus. The history syllabus back then was quite different to what it is now. Back then, they were... They had to take modern history students had to take political economy and geography and literature, so a broad range of subjects. And in fact, many of those books, as well as European history and English history, many of those books are still at the Instituto today. And that gives us a way into what both his career later on as an economist, as a historian, as an art collector, so very wide-ranging, but also it influenced what he collected, so not sort of ancient Greek and Roman artifacts, but from that period onwards, but also how he thought of the Osmond studentship. It wasn't about Spanish as a language, but it was about Spanish studies in sort of more general terms. It was about connecting Oxford with Spain, with its history, with its literature, with its art. So once he finished his degree here, Osmond, as Guillermo told us earlier, became a diplomat, and he served as the Spanish delegate to the International Monetary Conference in 1892, and later became an MP. But he was, as I said, a rare sight here in Oxford, but he was also equally a rare sight in Madrid. I mean, how many Oxonians were there in Madrid at the time? Osmond married Adela Crook, and I think her father and Osmond had quite a few things in common. So they were both diplomats, they were well travelled, they were polyglots, and so Don Guillermo would have fitted in quite well with her family. They build this beautiful home in Madrid, and which was in a neighbourhood that was not yet fully developed. And their house is particularly distinctive and did not conform to the shared taste of the aristocracy and high bourgeoisie in Madrid at the time, which typically shunned the cheap brick associated with middle and working class property developments in favour of French-inspired or historicist palafittes made of granite or marble and stucco. So their new choice of home reflected a great sense of social legitimacy, intellectual pursuit, and individuality. So its medieval style traced Adela's family title back to the son of Alfonso X, and that matched part of their collection, but it also corresponded with Osma's exposure to British architecture and taste here. So it was this sort of combination of the two. Osma and Adela had no children, and in 1915, despite having become an estranged couple, they decided to set up a private foundation to keep their collection safe. So in 1916, the Instituto Valencia Don Juan was officially established. The Board of Trustees was made up of five very distinguished men: Prime Minister Antonio Maura, Chair of the Board of Trustees, the Arabic scholar Miguel Asin Palacios, the Duke of Alba, Don Jacobo, the founder of the Hispanic Society of America, Archer Huntington, and the keeper of British and medieval antiquities at the British Museum and president of the London Society of Antiquaries, Sir Charles Reed, Hercules Reed. The statutes of the Instituto Valencia de Don Juan show the extent of Osma's trust and affection for his alma mater, and a strong wish to link his and Adela's newly established foundation with Oxford. Indeed, Article 7 states that the Instituto will report its work annually to the Chancellor of the University of Oxford. And the Instituto sent the Chancellor a detailed annual report and accounts from 1916 onwards, which included information ranging from heating bills to purchases of books and artworks. But perhaps the most surprising item in the statutes of the Instituto comes at the very end. The text of the final article states that it is the will of the founder that if the purposes of the Instituto should ever lapse through neglect into abeyance, or the terms of the foundation be manifestly infringed, the Instituto, in such case, should be considered as forming part of the University of Oxford. Therefore, the university has the mandate to ensure that the statutes are followed, and in cases in which statutory duty is breached, transfer the Instituto's collection and buildings to Oxford. So it is the wish of Osma to link the university with Spain, with the Instituto in Madrid. So in a way, bridging and linking the institution that had shaped him and had trained him with the institution that he created. So we know from Guillermo has told us that the collection is in the Instituto is wide ranging. This is one of the living rooms in the home sort of research center. There's a set of drawings which includes a print by Goya, which is a manual alphabet. The Instituto holds a collection of weapons and ammunition, and that's a picture of the library that that Bruce mentioned, and that there is a helmet from the 15th century that belonged to Mohammed II, the conqueror of Constantinople. So very wide-ranging. The Instituto's collection of Spanish ceramics is outstanding, stretching from the Muslim period to the 18th century. Osma, in fact, dedicated a significant amount of time and energy to that particular collection and published extensively on it. And indeed, we have a cartoon here, a caricature of Osma, shown, which shows him on his feet surrounded by piles of ceramic plates and vases in front of his Neo-Mudéjar-style house under a large banner that states La Cerámica Española, while he reads the Times newspaper, and his suit pockets overflow with scrolls and papers. So the image of a scholar, true scholar, while his dog, Cherry, no less a scholar, sits on a half-written parchment with an inkwell and a pen next to him, as well as several books, including the Anglo-Canine Dictionary. The Instituto also has a remarkable archive and book collection, as we've heard earlier. And I think it's important to stress that Osman, his wife, decided to keep this collection private, so not to donate it to the Spanish state, but to link it to Oxford in a way sort of to push the Instituto as a research centre. He, as I mentioned earlier, entrusted his old Oxford friend, Maurice de Bunsen, to set up a studentship at Oxford. So we've gone through Osmer's links with Oxford as a student, how he linked up his child in a way. You know, he didn't have any children, so the Instituto, so linking his Instituto to Oxford, and then creating a studentship to further link the Instituto with the university. So he entrusted his old Oxford friend Maurice de Bunsen to negotiate to set up a studentship at Oxford. I guess Osman was quite probably the only Spaniard of his time with a vocation and the background suitable to establish these close links between Spain and Oxford. So, and to that end, he encouraged Bunsen and Hubbard, who made a good strong working pair to establish the Osman studentship. So while Bunsen played the diplomat and focused more on the politics of negotiating the studentship, Hubbard took care of the financial and legal details. That's quite helpful if you've been a director of the Bank of England. And in fact, in a letter, Bunsen, on the subject of the negotiation process with the university, Osmer wrote that it is rather nice that we should all three be together in it, more than 40 ans après. So that making a clear reference to their old bond as their joint venture to set up the Osmer studentship. In 1920, when he was negotiating the studentship with the Vice-Chancellor, Bunsen wrote to Osmer saying, It is a most striking and I would think unique example of devotion to alma mater on the part of a non-Englishman, combined with the provision of very effective means of really permitting and promoting in a practical way the study of Spanish art and history. The studentship constituted the first modern Spanish-funded endowment at the oldest English-speaking university in the world. And Bunsen frequently quoted a line to Osmer by Horace, Exigi monumentum aere perennius. I have erected a monument more lasting than bronze, in reference to the Osmer studentship and to the Instituto and its links with Oxford. The Vice-Chancellor at the time, Vice-Chancellor Farnell, then went on to play a very important role in establishing the King Alfonso XIII chair in Spanish studies for modern languages at Oxford in 1927, motivated by his involvement with the Osmer studentship. So here's a list of some of the Osmer students we've had throughout the decades. You're not all on it, I couldn't fit you all on the slide. But the first appointment was made in Michaelmas 1920, and the first Osmer student was George Corkhurst,
The Colonel.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's how he's known. And he'd lived in Chile until the age of 14 and taken up Spanish at Oxford. And apparently, when he got the studentship, his accent changed. So on the way, the Spanish he had learnt in South America was dropped and replaced by the patrician Castilian, which used to impress both Spanish visitors to Oxford and his own pupils. And according to Russell, it was modelled on the speech of the late Duke of Alba, who befriended him when he was studying at the Instituto, and whose blending of scholarship with a grandeza he much admired. So that's a list of the Osmo students up till 98. I wanted, I don't know if you can see it properly, but 1935 and 1978 are highlighted in purple. Those are the first women to be awarded the studentship. So the studentship was also very special because it was open to both men and women from the very start. And that was something that Osmo decided himself. The studentship was worded in such a way that it didn't refer to men or women. It just said members of the university. And scholarships at the time were specifically worded to only refer to men. So that made this studentship, as I said, rather special. However, that didn't mean that in terms of the appointments, those guidelines were followed. So the first woman to be appointed, we have her descendants here today, Inez Pern. She was appointed in 1935. And there's a rather interesting letter of appointment by the Vice-Chancellor. And in a way is expressing a sense of apprehension. Miss Pern, he wrote, will be the first woman to hold this studentship, and I trust you will find her to be satisfactory and acceptable. He didn't say that about the men. A later chairholder of Alfonso XIII professorship, when he was asked to comment for the selection process in 1948, his reaction to women being appointed to the studentship was, one woman was once appointed, but she seems to have secured too marketed popularity, which meant that until 1978, no other woman was appointed an Osmo student. And that woman was also the first non-British student to receive the Osmo studentship. So we had to wait 70 years until the first non-British student was appointed an Osmo studentship. So perhaps had Osmo applied himself for his own studentship, he would have perhaps probably failed to get himself appointed, who knows? But a quick look also reveals that the recipients came from the older Oxford colleges until 1974. But perhaps the most evident pattern is the absence of Osmo students from 1936 to 1947. And war severely hindered international academic exchange between Oxford and the Instituto, and Spain more generally. However, this, despite Osmo students not being sent over to Madrid and having that opportunity to do research in Spain, there were other ways in which the links between Osmo and the Instituto and Oxford were expressed during these times of war. So when the Duke of Alba asked to be allowed to raise to claim the Instituto as British territory and as part of the University of Oxford. So he wrote to Lindsay, who was the Vice-Chancellor of the time, saying the University of Oxford is entitled, sort of reminding him, is entitled to intervene in the event of any danger threatening the Institute. The Institute has so far been under the protection of the British flag, and it appears to be the only museum in Madrid that has not suffered from intervention. But I now have reason to fear the possibility of intervention, which may be prejudicial to the museum, and that is why I am writing to you. So the university was very active in protecting the Instituto's collections. Osmo students have gone on to write scholarly works related to their research at the Instituto. Here are a few. examples. But also, there was a lot of creative output from linked to their stay in Madrid, in Spain. I won't talk about Spanish portrait because Inés Pan's descendants are here and they'll do a wonderful job. But I thought I'd say a few words about Federico García Lorca. So he met one of the Osmer students who was staying at the Residencia de Estudiantes in Madrid during his stay as an Osmer student. And Federico García Lorca actually he dedicated one of his poems in Cancionero to this Osmer student, and later this Osmer student was then became went to work to New York at the Stock Exchange, and took Federico García Lorca when he was there in New York to the Stock Exchange, and that experience is included in Poeta Nueva York. So there are many, so the point here is to sort of show you how wide-ranging the implications of the Osmer studentship have had, not only in the scholarly world, the academic world, but also in terms of creative output. And I think that goes back to Osmer and his student days here at Oxford, his interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary life, and his understanding of what the links between Britain and Spain should be, how we should break stereotypes and how we should bridge sort of the gap between both nations. And a wonderful way to do it is through academic collaborations and research. So thank you.